Welcome to Cannabis Health Radio, a podcast where we share stories from people around the world who are using cannabis as medicine. The information is meant to raise awareness about the health benefits of cannabis, but should not be taken as medical advice. Now, here are your hosts, Ian Jessup and Corey Yelland.
And we welcome you to another episode of Cannabis Health Radio. I'm Ian Jessup.
And I'm Corey Yelland.
Of the more than 325 interviews we've done over the years, many of the people we've interviewed have used cannabis successfully in dealing with multiple health issues. And today we're talking to a woman who had grand mal seizures as a youngster, breast cancer as an adult, and was involved in a serious traffic accident, which she became addicted to pharmaceuticals prescribed by her doctor. But being a cannabis advocate for most of her life, she has survived and is here today to tell us her story. And joining us from Ontario, Canada, is Kim Cooper. Kim, it's good to finally meet you and talk to you. Thanks very much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here with the two of you. I have followed what you guys have been doing for a very long time, and I'm thrilled to be participating in your podcast today.
Kim, what would your state of health be like today if cannabis wasn't part of your life?
Oh, I don't think I would be here. I honestly do not think I would have survived until, you know, my last 60 years without the use of cannabis. Over the years, I've suffered many chronic conditions that cannabis has helped me with. If a grand mal seizure didn't affect my brain, then I'm sure the breast cancer would have taken me, or addiction. At one point, I was addicted to some pretty heavy pharmaceuticals. If I would have stayed on that path, I'm not sure I would have survived.
Let's go back to the very beginning with your grand mal seizures. They started at the age of 12. And take us through that.
Puberty. This happens with a lot of people that wind up with epilepsy, diagnosed with epilepsy. The onset of puberty is what triggered my seizures. A few years after having the seizures, we found out that I was diagnosed with having a small brain tumor, and that's my going through pubescence is what triggered the reaction in that tumor to start my epilepsy. I was on phenobarbital and Dilantin, two pretty heavy pharmaceuticals, for about 2 years. They started me on those when I was 13 years old. And I had no life as a teenager. Everything was taken from me. I lived in bed, had no energy, and was a young junkie, so to speak.
Well, that Dilantin is horrible.
Yeah. Phenobarb is really bad as well. And it did. Dental issues since I was a teen. Yeah.
Tell us how you started smoking pot.
Through my teenage years, I was a fairly rebellious teen. I grew up in the social services system. So I was in amongst foster homes and group homes and that kind of thing throughout many years of my life. And that leads to some really rebellious behavior in the use. And you've got to put this in context. This was back in the 70s. You know, we're talking 75 through 79 is the majority of my experience where it all began. So rebelling through my teenage years, you know, after school, friends getting together with friends and we'd get our hands on some pot, and it's, you know, in the back of the schoolyard smoking joints after school. It started off as a rebel thing, and I noticed that my seizures had become less. I had been on the phenobarb and the Dilantin for just over a year by then, and I noticed a decrease in the seizure activity. I just thought they were going away, not knowing too much about my condition, and just figured, well, it came and it started, and now it's just leaving. So I started rebelling against my foster parents at that time, and I started refusing to take my pills. I said, no, I'm not taking them. I'm not having seizures anymore. I'm good. So I'm not taking the pills. And I never really put it together with the cannabis until after a visit with the doctor, where my foster mom used an opportunity to rat me out to the doctor. So 14 years old, and I'm sitting in the doctor's office, and my mom, foster mom, pops up and says, well, you know, she stopped taking her pills. And she's smoking that pot, she says, to the doctor, to the neurologist. And I sat straight up in my chair, being the rebellious teen that I was. And I said, yep, that's right. I'm not taking the pills no more, and I'm not having no more seizures. And I like smoking pot. And I thought I was going to get reamed on. And to our surprise, the doctor shifted himself around in the chair a little bit and said, well, you know, there's a scientific study that has put seizures activity on a decline with people that consume marijuana. And marijuana used to be one of the medicines that we would prescribe to people before it became illegal in the 60s. Well, I almost fell over, and my mother's jaw hit the floor, and my social worker that was with us was just dumbfounded, didn't know what to do, and I was jumping for joy in my chair, just thinking, yeah, this is what I want to hear. And at the time, I was strictly recreational. I didn't know anything about the medicinal values of cannabis, and I was not using it as a medicine. I want that to be clear. It was very young in the late 70s. So I didn't have a whole lot of information at that time, but I was just ecstatic at the fact that somebody was telling me it was okay for me to smoke pot.
That was a very enlightened doctor, wasn't it?
Yeah. He was a European, Scandinavian, I think. Mm-hmm. He was very educated on natural substances and the history of cannabis. Looking back now at the way he spoke, I think he was a cannabis consumer.
Wow. So when did you connect the dots that there was actually a medicinal purpose for cannabis?
That day, the light bulb went on. I took this newfound information, and I went out and home, and I scoured. I mean, again, back in the 70s, we didn't have Wi-Fi, we didn't have internet, we didn't have smartphones. So I was at the library, the public library, going through microfiche. For anybody that's older out there that would remember microfiche, that's the way you got all of these archived documents and newspaper articles that were, you know, ancient history. And you'd sit there on this big machine putting this little card in and just reading article after article and scouring historical documents for any reference to cannabis, or at that time we were using the term marijuana. And I found a lot of information that was buried in those library archives, and I took it and I ran with it, and I haven't stopped running since.
Now, you moved to West Virginia for a year, did you not?
I did. I lived in the wonderful state of West Virginia, little teeny town called Ripon, West Virginia, just outside Charleston. I worked at the Charleston racetrack, and I met my birth father there. He's a Native Indian, and he's lives in West Virginia, and he ran a horse farm down there. And I went and visited with him and met him for the first time after I discovered who he was, and we had some conversations. I decided to make the leap and go and meet him. When I got down there, he gave me a tour of his house, and he was showing me his yard. And what do I see lined up along the fence line but a glorious row of cannabis plants? And these things had to be over 6 feet tall, nice big bushes. They resembled more of a pine tree than they did of a cannabis plant that I had been used to seeing. I almost fell over. It's like, so maybe this is where I get it from.
What was the general attitude in Virginia towards cannabis back then?
Oh, it was completely demonized. I mean, if he had been caught with those plants, he would have been looking at 30 years in jail at that particular time. West Virginia had rolling papers were illegal, so they didn't even sell pouch tobacco because they would not sell rolling papers. They were that strict. All of the consumption that we did while I was in West Virginia, we made our own pipes, literal corn cob pipes, you know, finding rocks and seashells and stuff to decorate them with, using straws and sheets of pieces of bamboo for the spouts. I had more fun making pipes, I think, down there than anything else.
Now, Kim, you were there for a year, and you in West Virginia for a year, and then you came back to Canada. And at the age of 22, you got pregnant and decided to quit smoking cannabis. What happened?
Yeah, I was worried. It was my first pregnancy. It was going to be a first-time mom. You know, you want to do everything right for your child. That's the objective of all parents that are ready to give birth and expecting a child. You want to do the right thing through your pregnancy. I wasn't sure about cannabis use and the effects on the baby. I hadn't done a lot of research on that, and there wasn't a lot of information out there that was readily available. So I quit for a little while, and I thought, well, you know, maybe it's better for the baby if I don't do this while I'm pregnant. Within a matter of a week of quitting using cannabis on a daily basis, my seizures returned. I had a small grand mal seizure within a few days, and then a few days later, I had a major grand mal seizure that really took me out. And the effects of those seizures on the unborn child, as far as I was concerned, far outweighed my use of using cannabis. Using cannabis and going back to using cannabis to control the seizures was the only option that I could see. I was not ready to take a pharmaceutical drug that I was going to ingest orally, because I thought that would have more detrimental effects on the unborn child than consuming oral consumption or vaporization or inhalation of cannabis. I found as the only option for me to keep the baby safe and to keep me seizure free while I carried her.
You know, Kim, one of the very fascinating things that I read in your blog when you told your story is that when you were delivering the baby, you had a grand mal seizure. Tell us about that.
I did. I was 4 days in labor. I had a very, very rough labor. My daughter still to this day is extremely stubborn. She was stubborn coming out, and she's still stubborn at the age of 36. She didn't want to come. I went into labor, and she got to a point, and then she just kind of stopped and wanted to stay there nice and comfy. So 4 days of that in the hospital, walking back and forth. Of course, there was no cannabis consumption in the hospital, and I wasn't able to use my cannabis for that 4 days. When she was finally arrived and I was delivering her, she got about halfway out, and my doctor noticed that I was going into a seizure. They literally ripped her out of me. They pulled her out as fast as they could so that I didn't harm her by clamping down on her during a grand mal seizure. But that was 4 days without cannabis, and bang, the seizures were back. I could have killed her. If you know, she was halfway out, I could have strangled her with the convulsions that I was having. I would have clamped down on her neck, and it was a very traumatic thing for me to go through, because when I woke up, that was my first thought. Oh, where's the baby? Is the baby okay? It was a pretty scary situation. So 4 days without consumption, and my seizures were back.
Wow.
Now, you have three children. Were they all as difficult to deliver as your first?
All of them. They were all late. They weren't as difficult as the first, but they were all late. I don't know. I guess I have a cozy womb. They don't want to leave. They were all late, but the other three did arrive without complication. I didn't have days in labor with the others, and I consumed cannabis through all three pregnancies. The final two, I didn't take a I didn't stop, and I didn't have any seizure activity that would interfere with the development of the baby or the delivery.
Now, do those seizures continue to be at bay today?
Yes, I went 25 years seizure free. I had one seizure just this past summer, first one I have had in 25 years, and it was caused from a perfect storm of incidences that happened. There was, you know, some stressors that were happening. There was a lot of stuff that was going on. Just a perfect storm of circumstances came together. And I did have a minor grand mal seizure this year, but that was the first one I've had in 25 years.
Wow, that is incredible.
That is incredible. Kim, how did breast cancer impact you? When did that happen?
I found out, I was diagnosed when I found a lump in my breast, and I went and I got it checked, and it turned out they wanted to do a biopsy, and it was breast cancer. My mother passed away from breast cancer. She was diagnosed with breast cancer when she was in her 20s, held it at bay for a number of years. It came back in two other spots within her body, and it eventually took her by the time she was only 50 years old when she passed away. So when I got diagnosed, I got pretty scared. And I dove back into cannabis again, and I was, you know, hearing about Rick Simpson oil and using Rick Simpson oil for cancer. And so I dove back into the research, and I said, well, I have to find out more about this. I started making my oil. I used it as a paste, as a topical after the surgery. They had surgery to remove the lump. I used it as a paste on top of the area, and I started taking the RSO capsules every day. And I fought it that way. I went back for an exam. They did want to do chemotherapy given my history. I went back for an exam 3 months after my surgery, and through blood work and exam, they found no cancer.
Wow. So was this, do you know, Kim, or do you recall if it was hormone driven or triple negative or triple positive or what?
Really, back then, I really don't know. I didn't do a lot of due diligence. That was after my car accident, and I wasn't in a clear frame of mind from a lot of the pharmaceuticals that I was on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How long did it take for you to get clear?
Clear-minded or clear from cancer?
Either. Clear from cancer.
Clear-minded. Clear from cancer. I remained cancer-free for about 6 years. Then I found another lump. They did more surgery, biopsies, and came back. It was cancer once again. But I had stopped taking the RSO. After I got cleared the first time, I thought, okay, well, I'm good. So I stopped taking the RSO, and that gave the cancer a chance to come back. I didn't know you were supposed to stay on it for life at that time. I thought, okay, it's done the job. I'm good to go. So I didn't do a maintenance dose, and that was my biggest mistake. It gave the cancer a chance to come back. Another lump, more surgery. I did the same protocol again, and I have not stopped taking the RSO. Now I do a maintenance dose every day, have done ever since my second surgery, and still to this day, I am now cancer free.
Fantastic.
That's amazing. That's great.
Now, in 2002, within 2 years of the car accident, you were on 16 pills a day and wearing a narcotics patch. Tell us about the car accident and what life was like for you after that.
I was coming home from work. I drove transit bus for one of the smaller cities just on top of Toronto. And I was on my way home from work, and I was highway driving one of our major 400 international highways that we have here, and high speed. So it was a bad accident. It was a multi-car pileup. Several vehicles that were involved. I was basically sandwiched between two cars. I broke my back. I had several discs out of place in my spine. arm damage, neck damage, a lot of ligament damage and that kind of thing. Hospitalized for several months and in traction. So I had people bringing me in cannabis while I was in the hospital. And nurses were yelling and screaming because we were smoking cannabis in the room. And people were bringing me in my capsules and edibles and all kinds of things while I was in the hospital. When they released me from the hospital, I was on 16 pills a day. And within 1 year, that increased to 16 pills a day plus a 150 milligram fentanyl patch. I went, you know, 6-8 years just with not a lot of recollection of that time. It's a haze, it's a fog, bits and pieces scattered here and there. I stopped being a mother to my children. I stopped being a wife to my husband, and my husband became my caregiver.
Did you realize you were addicted to them?
No. Mm-hmm. No. They ramp you up slowly. I mean, by the time I got out of that hospital, I was eating all the pills because of the pain that you're in initially from the car accident. By the time you're addicted to all of this stuff, you're now in such a fog you can't think straight. So mm-hmm. you don't even see what's happening to you. It's happening at such a slow rate and for such a long period of time. There is no time for an awakening because you're just in a fog. I was on a morphine drip while I was in the hospital. And then when they released me with pills, the pills weren't enough to replace that morphine drip that I was on for several months. So I would complain, hey, it's not working on the pain. So they'd up the dose, then they'd up the level, and then they'd up the pill. And you'd go from, you know, Percocets to Percodon to morphine to fentanyl. And they just keep giving you more.
Mm-hmm. Were you consuming cannabis at all during this period?
Yeah, I still was smoking my joints and stuff for my seizures. I mean, it's been part of my life, my entire life. I've really not stopped that. Mm-hmm. But my consumption levels decreased dramatically, where cannabis was my go-to for pretty much anything. I got a headache, I'm smoking a joint. I don't feel well, I'm smoking a joint. Anything's out of whack, I'm in a bad mood, I'm smoking a joint. And that was my life for, you know, a couple of decades already. By the time the car accident happened. But with the pills and the fog, you're not thinking clearly. And at the times that I would normally reach for a joint, I was now at the point where I was reaching for an Ativan or antidepressant or, you know, a nerve pill.
How long were you in this state?
8 years.
8 years.
10 years, almost 10 years by the time I woke up. And I literally just had a moment of clarity one day sitting on my couch. I don't know where it came from, what caused it. I have no idea, but it was a moment of clarity. And I just sat on my couch and I'll never forget it. Sitting there and I kind of looked around and I felt like, where am I? I don't know where I am. And I was looking around and I was just confused. And I just looked at my husband and I just said, how did I get here? What's going on? And I realized it's like, okay, it's been 8 years. What happened? Mm-hmm. And I just started sobbing. I was devastated. My life was gone.
So how did you get off the pills?
Me, myself, and I, and my will and my determination, and I owe it all to that moment of clarity. My husband's support. I wouldn't have been able to get through this without him. I told him, I said, I'm done. I can't do this no more. I don't want these pills. And I started, you know, researching about getting off the pills. I spoke to the doctor about it. The doctor said, no, you can't get off the pills. You need the pills. And, da, 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 da. And that just made me more determined to get off them because he wasn't listening to me. And so I went off and did my own research as I always do. And I said, okay, well, I got to learn how to do this. And I found out, okay, you got to do it slow. You've got to do it one pill at a time. And you've got to decrease slowly. You can't go cold turkey. or you wind up in organ failure. I could wind up back in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And I don't want that because they'll only put you on more pills if that happens. So methodically, slowly, over the course of 4.5 long years, it took me to get off of every one of those pharmaceuticals.
So did you actually put together a game plan of how you were going to do this? So obviously you were decreasing the pills, et cetera. Did you kind of put in, okay, so when I'm supposed to take this pill instead, I'm going to have a hit of a joint? Or how did you do it?
Yeah. I started using edibles and I started consuming more cannabis. I increased my cannabis consumption for every pill I got rid of. I increased my cannabis and the methods that I was using to ingest. I started using topicals, edibles, and finding out more and more about different methods to use cannabis. The more every pill I got rid of, I added in more cannabis dosing. As my pills went down, my cannabis consumption went up.
So when you're titrating like this and you're in, you know, substituting the cannabis for the pills, what was the pain level like? What was the pain control like? Did you notice an increase in the pain control, decrease?
Increase. Absolutely. It was an increase. And a lot of that was, I believe, psychosomatic as well. You get into habits, you know, with our body. The body knows if you do this, it hurts. Well, if it's better and you do this and it still hurts, sometimes that's our own brains fooling us, because and a lot of that has to do with the addiction. The addiction signals are going off in your head. Oh, this is going to hurt you. You need a pill. So you'll actually feel pain in order to make you take that pill. And that's the addiction speaking to you. So you have to, first of all, learn the difference between the psychosomatic pain and the real pain. And finding out the differences and differentiations is extremely important. I just kept on increasing my cannabis. If I was in pain, I would lay on the couch and I would put up the pain. It was like, okay, no. Just because you feel it doesn't mean you have to reach for something to stop feeling it. Maybe I need to feel this. Maybe I need to learn how to move differently so that that doesn't happen. Learning how to get up off a chair differently so it doesn't hurt when you get up off the chair, then you don't feel the need to reach for a pill. And the cannabis consumption, as it increased and as I learned my own body and my own body signals, the pains started to subside. I learned proper dosing, proper strain. A lot of it will be strain related as well. If you don't have the right strain that's working for you, you're going to have increased pain. So I was learning about all of that and getting the right strains in for what I needed.
Kim, you said you were on, it took you 4.5 years to get off pharmaceuticals. Do you remember the day when you finally did and the next day you didn't take any?
Yeah, I do. And it wasn't all that long ago. You know, I've only been completely pharmaceutical free for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And my anniversary date is actually coming up next week.
Oh, wow.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah.
It's really good. What is your cannabis consumption on a daily basis at the moment?
Oh, she's a wreck.
She's a wreck.
it's pretty high. I haven't actually sat and calculated it for quite some time. For my inhalation, I have primarily switched over to extracts. I find the extracts at a higher dosage level allows me to inhale less, but get more medicine faster at a higher dose level without inhaling as much. I've switched over to vaporization over smoking joints. I smoke very few joints now. Vaporizing, I think, is better on your lungs. I'm not causing damage to my lungs with the smoke, so vaporization is my go-to, and extracts are my favorite for sure for the higher dose levels of THC to control all of the symptoms and still allow me to function. So I probably vaporize about, it's got to be close to a half ounce of concentrates per month. And I use RSO capsules. I'm at just under 1 gram a day every day. I use bath bombs. My soap has cannabinoid therapy in it. I have topicals, and I also use suppositories.
Wow, you've covered all your bases. That's fantastic.
Yes.
When you look back... When you look back at your life, and particularly that vague period when you were on pharmaceuticals, and I say vague for you because you indicated that you didn't remember much of it, what goes through your mind?
I beat myself up a lot because I don't know how I could have allowed myself to get there. I've been educated on cannabinoid therapy, even if it was, limited to pertain to what I needed it for at that time, which was seizure activity. I don't understand how I allowed myself to get roped in onto that pharmaceutical train so easily. And that's scary, because somebody that is educated as I was, that was still able to happen to me. So the novice going into that, somebody that doesn't know anything about cannabinoid therapy or natural therapies out there, really, when you look at that, it explains how we have the addiction rates that we have today. Doctors just writing out prescriptions for, you've got a toothache and you're going home with a bottle of Perks now, where, 30 years ago, you would have been told to take an Advil. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem today. It's the freewheeling prescriptions. We're getting high dose narcotics prescribed to us for something that would normally an aspirin would suffice. And it's scary to me. I'm fearful for the future if we don't get this curbed. And if it can happen to me that easily, it can happen to anybody. And we need to get a rein on that.
It can be really insidious.
Yeah.
Kim, how do your kids feel about your cannabis use?
They grew up with it, so to them it's a normal part of life. Mm-hmm. Even when I was, on all of the pharmaceuticals, as I said, I was still consuming cannabis. They grew up with it. It's been in the house since they were all born. I used it through my pregnancies. They've seen it their entire lives. That's mommy's medicine. And that's the way they've always viewed it.
But they also remember the period when you were the almost 10 years when you were on pharmaceuticals too, and the difference.
Yeah.
The difference.
Yeah,
in you.
They remember that, and they see that, and they're like, "Yeah, they're all three are very much anti-pharma." My oldest, the least amount of anti-pharma, she understands the issues with pharmaceuticals, but she's still pro-pharmaceutical, but that's because she wound up being a registered nurse. So she works in a hospital as a registered nurse and dispenses these pharmaceuticals on a regular basis. So she's gone over to the other side a little bit.
Well, she'll come back. I suspect she will.
Hey, Kim, what would you say is the most profound or memorable thing that cannabis has done for you?
I always come back to it saved my life. There's so much. Corey, cannabis has been intertwined into my life on so many occasions where it literally saved my life. I don't think I would have survived as a teen on the phenobarb and the dilantin. I definitely wouldn't be who I am today if I would have stayed on that path. The cancer coming, it saved my life there. There was no way I was going through chemotherapy. As soon as I stopped taking the cannabis, the cancer came back. So, you know, I think that would have taken my life for sure, as it did my mother's. After the car accident, that whole pharmaceutical train, I don't think I would be here today if I was still on 150 milligrams of fentanyl changed out every 2 days. Guaranteed, I would have succumbed to that. It's literally saved my life three separate occasions.
Kim, in conclusion, what advice would you give to people who are really on the fence about the use of cannabis for medicinal purposes?
Well, when I say to anybody that's unsure, I say, well, you know, it comes down to it's a plant. You know, we say everything that is on this earth is on this earth for a purpose. Whatever God you believe in, or being that you believe in, or higher power that you believe that things are here for a purpose. You know, we have water because we need water to live. We have cannabis because it's a medicine, the same as we have everything else on this planet that is living in symbiosis and has a purpose to be here. Cannabinoids are produced inside a person's body. When one is pregnant, you're producing cannabinoids inside your mother's milk to feed to your child. That is one of the first things that your child will consume, contains naturally made cannabinoids produced by the mother. We're supposed to be consuming this in order to provide symbiosis and to have your body live in harmony and to maintain health, the same as anything else that we're supposed to consume, like vitamin C, vitamin D, and all of the other wonderful elements out there in nature that keep us healthy.
Very well said, Kim. Kim, it was a pleasure to talk to you, and a wonderful story, and I'm so glad that you are, I guess you're recovered, or you're on the road to recovery, but you're feeling a hell of a lot better than you did for those periods when you were on pharmaceuticals. Thanks very much for doing this.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure to be here. Love your show.
Thanks, Kim, so much. And yeah, great interview, and really liked the way you shared about differentiating between the addiction pain. That's, I think, going to be really helpful to people. Thanks, Kim.
Awesome. Thanks so much, guys. Appreciate it. Shoot me a link when it's out and I'll share it.
Will do.
Bye-bye.
And we thank Kim for sharing her story. And if you enjoy our podcasts, we'd love it if you subscribe, rate, and write a review about Cannabis Health Radio on your social media platforms. It really helps us, gets us more people listening. And the more people who listen, the more people can benefit from this information. And we'd also like to thank our listeners for supporting us and sharing our podcast with others who would benefit from hearing these testimonials about the use of cannabis. And our purpose in doing this is very simple. We want to help as many people as we can. And we don't have any advertising. We're listener supported. And if you'd like to make a one-time donation or a monthly donation, regardless of the amount, go to our website, cannabishealthradio.com, and a drop-down menu will show you how you can do that, and it's very easy. We're very grateful for your support, and thanks very much for listening. And I'd also like to thank Ron Zahar for donating his studio time to us, and also Mark in Belgium for posting our podcasts on YouTube and Rumble, which YouTube, we find, has started to censor some of our podcasts. And Rumble just puts them up, and you're free to make your own judgments on it. And thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back again next week with another episode of Cannabis Health Radio.
Thanks for listening to Cannabis Health Radio. For more information and to search previous podcasts, visit our website, cannabishealthradio.com. Subscribe so you don't miss new episodes. And follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. This podcast is made possible by donations from our listeners. If you found the information helpful, please consider making a donation in any amount through our website. You can also help us share our message by leaving a review on your podcast listening platform. We are very grateful for your support. Thank you.